Pakistan's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With the new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s and there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Based on official statistics, systematic targeting of Shia people in Afghanistan kicked off almost 7 years ago. Since then, over 1,000 Shia civilians have been killed and many others wounded, including women and children, in tens of separate attacks such as bomb blasts or targeted killings.
Our people face a real systematic genocide, and this trend has drawn a very dark future for us. We have been repeatedly targeted by brutal terrorist attacks, mainly in western Kabul. I think gone are those days when people were killed because of their belief or ethnicity.
However, it seems that the time for killing of Shia people has already arrived for the terrorist groups, mainly Daesh.
This comes as the Afghan presidential palace has promised to implement a comprehensive security plan in western Kabul to tackle security threats there. However, there is still no positive change in the security situation in the Shia-dominated area of western Kabul.
In the latest incident on Saturday evening, two minivans were blown up in western Kabul. The twin blasts claimed the lives of at least 7 Shia civilians and wounded more than 10 others. In the meantime, some prominent Shia leaders urged the government to either urgently unveil its own security plan for western Kabul or approve people's security plan to protect Shia people against terrorist attacks and bombings.
The government must provide our people with security, otherwise the situation will get more dangerous. This will force peaceful people to pick up guns once again to protect themselves against violence.
Afghan government blames Taliban for targeting Shia population. Taliban, however, reject the accusation. This comes as Daesh proudly claims responsibility for most of such attacks and even warned of launching more and more attacks on Shia people across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do because there's a lot of uh, there's a obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is a, as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of US foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against, and one abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Nguyen Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed.
As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity, and wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
get up. Good morning.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
The debate.
and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 international summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
Well, dear, it was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the U.S. president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through U.S. politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. The whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, which was the Good Friday Agreement, which binding international agreement, which they've signed on to. And the terms that they've agreed for the to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, I mean, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end results of this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties. And the utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, you know, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland, because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet himself, you know, yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson, he claims that the EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain. But again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much vaunted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this exit, premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, you know, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs. You know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which
right.
is now gradually going to get exposed.
Go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU is threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson's posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, that they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreements as they agreed be actually implemented. You know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over and over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland. They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And you know, the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But, I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. Much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. And, I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, UK's, rather the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whether it's constructing this, whether they actually want, from British policymakers, like whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, you know, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is going in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folk that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically. You know, 20-30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions. And they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French President Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered. They could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals, but they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs, and it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. He didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, the real tragedy of Britain, there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know, the union was a Conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. Again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line. And whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in. You know, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line. You know, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc. That's also going to be, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. Brexit, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe. You know, how that was one thing which was mooted. One of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone, the strength of its currency was higher. You know, but again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then of course the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, you know, the labor shortage that I've briefly mentioned would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants. There's been a massive exodus in I think almost some quotes I've had are up to 1 million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain. You know, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence the intelligence networks.
Sure.
You know, the sharing of information. Which was there on the cards, that's all going to be much, much more difficult to sort of access. They're not going to be as freely giving in
okay.
that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that the foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbo. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also, thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
When ordinary people all over the world can see the dangers and pitfalls of following the United States as a model and a leader, why do their neoliberal leaders keep showing up to lend credibility to the posturing of U.S. leaders at summits like the G7 and NATO? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis authors. This article is published under the heading, Why Democracies in G7 and NATO Should Reject U.S. Leadership. Stay tuned for more. The world has been treated to successive spectacles of national leaders gathering at a G7 summit in Cornwall and a NATO summit in Brussels. The U.S. corporate media have portrayed these summits as chances for President Biden to rally the leaders of the world's democratic nations in a coordinated response to the most serious problems facing the world, from the COVID pandemic, climate change, and global inequality, to ill-defined threats to democracy. But there is something seriously wrong with this picture. Democracy means rule by the people. While that can take different forms in different countries and cultures, there is a growing consensus in the United States that the exceptional power of wealthy Americans and corporations to influence election results and government policies has led to a de facto system of government that fails to reflect the will of the American people on many critical issues. So when President Biden meets with the leaders of democratic countries, he represents a country that is in many ways an undemocratic outlier rather than a leader among democratic nations. This is evident in the legalized bribery of 2020's $14.4 billion federal election, compared with recent elections in Canada and the UK that cost less than 1% of that under strict rules that ensure more democratic results. A defeated president proclaiming baseless accusations of fraud and inciting a mob to invade the U.S. Congress in January 2021. News media that have been commercialized, consolidated, gutted, and dumbed down by their corporate owners, making Americans easy prey for misinformation by unscrupulous interest groups and leaving the U.S. in 44th place on Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index, the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world, with over 2 million people behind bars, and systematic police violence on a scale never seen in other wealthy nations. The injustice of extreme inequality, poverty, and cradle-to-grave debt for millions in an otherwise wealthy nation. An exceptional lack of economic and social mobility compared to other wealthy countries that is the antithesis of the mythical American dream. Privatized, undemocratic, and failing education and healthcare system. A recent history of illegal invasions, massacre of civilians, torture, drone assassinations, extraordinary renditions and indefinite detention at Guantanamo with no accountability. And last but not the least, a gargantuan war machine capable of destroying the world in the hands of this dysfunctional political system. Fortunately, though, Americans are not the only ones asking what is wrong with American democracy. The Alliance of Democracies Foundation, ADF, founded by former Danish Prime Minister and NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, conducted a poll of 50,000 people in 53 countries between February and April 2021 and found that people around the world share our concerns about America's dystopian political system and imperial outrages. Probably the most startling result of the poll to Americans would be its finding that more people around the world, that is 44%, see the United States of America as a threat to democracy in their countries than China or Russia, which makes nonsense of U.S. efforts to justify its revived Cold War on Russia and China in the name of democracy. In a larger poll of 124,000 people that ADF conducted in 2020, countries where large majorities saw the United States as a danger to democracy included China, but also Germany, Austria, Denmark, Ireland, France, Greece, Belgium, Sweden, and Canada. But we take solace from evidence that the people of Europe, whom the NATO war plan counts on as frontline troops and mass casualty victims, are not ready to follow President Biden to war. A January 2021 survey by the European Council on Foreign Affairs found that large majorities of Europeans want to remain neutral in any U.S. war on Russia or China. Only 22% would want their country to take the U.S. side in a war on China, and 23% in a war on Russia. The antipathy of ordinary people everywhere toward the U.S. determination to provoke military confrontation with Russia and China begs serious questions about the complicity of their leaders in these incredibly dangerous, possibly suicidal U.S. policies. When ordinary people all over the world can see the dangers and pitfalls of falling the United States as a model and a leader, why do their neoliberal leaders keep showing up to lend credibility to the posturing of U.S. leaders at summits like G7 and NATO? Maybe the leaders of other wealthy countries and military powers are genuinely awed by the dystopian American dream as the example par excellence of how to sell inequality, injustice, and war to the public in the name of freedom and democracy. In that case, the fact that people in other wealthy countries are not so easily led to war or lured into political passivity and impotence would only increase the awe of their leaders for their American counterparts, who literally laugh all the way to the bank as they pay lip service to the sanctity of the American dream and the American people. Ordinary people in other countries are right to be wary of the Pied Piper of American leadership, but the rulers should be too. The fracturing and disintegration of American society should stand as a warning to neoliberal governments and ruling classes everywhere to be more careful what they wish for. Instead of a world in which other countries emulate or fall victim to America's failed experiment in extreme neoliberalism, the key to a peaceful, sustainable, and prosperous future for all the world's people, including Americans, lies in working together, learning from each other, and adopting policies that serve the public good and improve the lives of all, especially those most in need. There is a name for that. It's called democracy for people.
Good morning. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.